Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.
Today's program has been brought to you by Cane Vineyard and Winery, a Napa Valley winery committed to respecting the soil and dedicated to the creation of three Cabernet blends. For more information, visit cane5.com.
They weren't letting their doctoral students do dissertation projects on food, or if they were doing dissertation projects on food issues, they weren't treated very well. Oh, has that changed? Now, everybody is doing projects on food issues. I can't keep up with them. And the issues are important. You know, if you change somebody's diet, you're making them healthier. If you change the way food is produced, you're changing the environment. These are not trivial issues.
Heritage Radio Network proudly presents Evolutionaries. Marion Nestle. Marion Nestle is one of the leading food educators in modern history, a pioneer in the food studies movement who has changed the lives of thousands through her teachings. She's a consumer activist, nutritionist, award-winning author, and academic who specializes in the politics of food and dietary choice. Marion Nestle is the Paulette Goddard Professor of Nutrition, Food Studies, and Public Health at NYU in the very department that she chaired from 1988 through 2003. Her academic journey started in UC Berkeley in 1954, but something happened to her as a child that would change her forever.
Where I learned about food was at a summer camp in Vermont. I was sent to a summer camp in Vermont that was run by a woman who had lived in China for a great deal of her life and was a fabulous upscale Chinese cook. And this camp was on a farm in southern Vermont, and there was a very, very large vegetable garden. And if you were a good camper, and as a privilege, you could go out and pick the vegetables for the night's dinner. And I remember, I still remember going out to the garden one night and picking green beans and biting into one. And it must have been July, and it was still hot from the sun. And it was the most extraordinary taste and texture. I mean, I've never forgotten it. It was just amazing. Never tasted anything like that before. All of the green beans that I had ever eaten were cooked to death, canned, heavily salted, and, you know, they'd been murdered. And here was this absolutely delicious crisp. I could just not stop eating them. And we had berries, you know, vast fields of berries and wild berries growing in the hills. And the woman who ran the camp would take those and make blueberry pancakes or raspberry pancakes or something like that. They also had a sugaring off place, and you could go up there during the winter and have real maple syrup. I mean, these were things that I had never tasted before. I thought they were wonderful. And I knew I was interested in food, that there was something about it that was just extraordinarily attractive and pleasurable. And my mother had a friend who collected cookbooks, which, of course, everybody was very contemptuous of the time. She had an enormous collection of cookbooks. Oh, how I wish I knew what happened to that collection and how I regret not acquiring it. But when I went to Berkeley, I wanted to study food, but there were two options. One was agriculture, and I was a city girl. I didn't get agriculture at all at the time. Oh, and the other was dietetics, and I signed up as a dietetic major at Berkeley. I lasted exactly one day, and that was the end of that. I ended up getting a degree in bacteriology because I was interested in science. I was in a chemistry class on my first day at Berkeley, and I liked it and was interested in science. And at one point, I did some calculations, and I was tired of school and I wanted to finish and I could graduate quickest in bacteriology. So I did. And then went to work for a couple of years. I was married. I had kids. And then I went back to graduate school in molecular biology. Yeah, I was in graduate school in the early 60s at Berkeley. It was during the Vietnam War and it was during the free speech movement. And I was actively engaged in it in the sense that I was enormously sympathetic. My husband at the time was a lawyer for the arrested students during the free speech movement. But I had two small children. And I understood for the first time why women were rarely revolutionaries, because who was going to take care of my kids if I got arrested? There was no question that I could not be arrested and that I had to stay out of that kind of trouble. So I did. And I went to meetings and I went to rallies and I often brought the children to things that they probably shouldn't have been brought to. But they were too young to complain.
Having completed her BA in bacteriology and her PhD in molecular biology at UC Berkeley by 1968, Marion Nessel found herself looking for the next chapter in her life. In 1976, she was hired as Associate Dean for Human Biology and taught nutrition at the UCSF School of Medicine. It wasn't until she lost her job that she decided to make a career-defining transition and work towards an MPH from UC Berkeley in Public Health Nutrition.
I lost my job at UCSF. I mean, I was basically fired. A new dean came in and wanted to bring his own staff. And I was then an associate dean at the medical school in San Francisco, and I was the only one of the senior administrators who didn't have tenure. So I was in really big trouble, and I was going to have to find another job, and I didn't know what to do. And everybody said, well, you can't teach nutrition. You don't have credentials for it. So somebody advised me to go get credentials in nutrition, and the easiest way to do that would be to get a master's in public health. And it wasn't just that it was the easiest way. It was also the way that made the most sense, because when I looked back over my career at that point, I could see that I was doing public health. And when I read the public health journals, I could see that the jobs that were available to people with master's in public health degrees were just exactly the kind of work that I would want to do. So I went to the University of California in Berkeley and did a one-year MPH and had a wonderful time. It was a great thing to do. I mean, I didn't really think I needed an additional degree, but there was no question that this opened doors, and I was promised that it would open doors. Didn't really believe it. But the kinds of things that you do in public health school get you out in the world, and you meet people and you find out what's going on and you find out what you like to do. And as part of that degree program, we were required to do a 10-week internship with some public health agency. And I asked the Agency for International Development if I could be considered for jobs when I finished the MPH. And they said, you don't have any international experience. And I said, well, how about some international experience? And they said, okay, we can do that. We need somebody to go to Southeast Asia to do a project, and maybe we'll just send you to that. And they did. So I spent the summer after my MPH coursework in Southeast Asia doing an investigation on urban malnutrition in Bangkok and Jakarta, and I also taught a course in China that summer. It was really a terrific thing to do, and as part of all the negotiations about all that, I had arranged to go to Washington the following year to work in the Office of Disease Prevention and Health Promotion. They were looking for somebody with an MPH who knew something about public health, who knew something about nutrition, and who could help with the editing of a report that was in very big trouble called the Surgeon General's Report on Nutrition and Health. It had just gone through three or four project officers, eaten them alive, and they needed somebody who could bring that report to completion. And I had just finished writing a book about nutrition for medical students. I'd reviewed everything. I could have written that whole thing myself and practically did.
3 degrees and a government job later, Marion had a pretty deep understanding of the way food, nutrition, and health worked in this country. But she still hadn't found the right outlet for her work. Luckily, she answered a call from NYU that wouldn't only change her life, but the lives of generations of students to come.
NYU is the only job I got. I mean, I was looking for jobs in New York for almost 2 years. Everybody I knew that I was looking for jobs in New York. And when the NYU position was advertised, it was chair of home economics at the time, I think probably 30 people sent me copies of the ad with little notes on it saying, Marion, here's your job. And so I applied for it and got it. What happened in the department at NYU is in general what happened to NYU over that period. I've been lucky enough to be there during a period of rapid growth, rapid development, and much of it for the better. When I started out, the department was home economics and nutrition. It was a small department with a few faculty, a lot of students, 35 degree programs being run by 5 faculty. We ended up closing the 25 home economics programs. Many of them had only 1 or 2 students in them. The department's facilities were in 2 different buildings and were very shabby. The department had been neglected for a very long time. It had a teaching kitchen that was, how can I put this, dirty, and needed a great deal of work. It was very difficult for me at first to figure out where to even start on improving the curriculum, professionalizing the department, and cleaning up the kitchen. I had a pretty good idea in 1995 when we first started working on it that this was something that would work. I had been traveling with a group called Old Ways Preservation and Exchange Trust and going to a lot of meetings in a lot of wonderful places with wonderful people who were interested in food. And I could see that there was an enormous interest in studying about food and that there were very few places to do that. I knew that Boston University had a program, a master's program in gastronomy. I didn't think that would work for NYU. We needed something more rigorously academic. And we had a lucky break. A program in our department in food management was taken away from us and moved into the School of Continuing Education at NYU. That was a program that generated about $1 million a year in student tuition revenue. Everybody was feeling really sorry for us for the loss. And so when the dean told me that this was going to be moved and there was really nothing that she or I could do about it, she said, how do you feel about it? I said, it depends on what I get. And she said, well, what do you want? I said, I want food studies. And she was a little shocked by that and said she felt it was very, very risky. And if we could have a plan B so that if it didn't work out, we wouldn't be putting a faculty member in grave risk for coming to lead up this program, she would go for it. And she went for it. And when the program was approved by the state in the summer of 1996, the New York Times wrote about it the next week. And we had students in our office that afternoon holding copies of the clipping saying, I've waited all my life for this program. We knew we had a hit. And now, of course, everybody has them.
Marion didn't stop in the classroom. Over her career, she has published a handful of groundbreaking books, perhaps the most popular being Food Politics, which was published in 2002.
Yeah, Food Politics was the first book that I wrote that got attention, and its genesis went back 10 or 15 years. In the early 1990s, I went to a meeting at the National Cancer Institute that was headed up by then Surgeon General C. Everett Koop. Actually, he had just been fired. And he was no longer Surgeon General, but he was still quite active in the public health arena. And he chaired a meeting at the National Cancer Institute on behavioral causes of cancer. And there were 2 behavioral causes that were discussed at that meeting. One was cigarette smoking, and the other was dietary factors. And Jane Brody from the New York Times and I were the 2 speakers on diet. Everybody else was cigarettes. And I had never heard the anti-cigarette advocates speak about cigarettes before. I certainly knew that cigarettes were bad for health and smoking was bad for health and that you weren't supposed to smoke. And I knew that cigarette companies did evil things. But I had never really examined their marketing in any systematic way. And at this meeting, they were all physicians. One physician after another showed slides. This was before PowerPoint. So they were showing slides of representations of cigarette marketing in the most amazing places, the jungles of Africa, the remote villages in the high Himalayas, places all over the world. They were showing pictures of the way cigarettes were marketed. And I thought that was amazing. And then physician John Pierce, who's a cancer researcher at the University of California, San Diego, gave a talk on food marketing to children. And this one just took my breath away because he showed slide after slide after slide of Joe Camel and other ways in which cigarettes were marketed to children at that time. And it wasn't that I wasn't aware of Joe Camel or cigarette marketing to children. I had certainly seen it before, but I had never paid any attention to it. It was completely below my radar. And of course, it was supposed to be below my radar. And I walked out of his talk thinking, we should be doing this for Coca-Cola. This is exactly what Coca-Cola does. And I started paying attention. And so paying attention led to a series of professional articles written in professional journals on a whole series of issues related to marketing of foods to children. And in the late 1990s, when I had a sabbatical coming up and I needed a sabbatical project, I had figured out by then that NYU valued books in its academic people very highly. I didn't have a book. I needed a book. And I thought, well, I would take those articles, and in my sabbatical year, I could throw them together into a book, and that would solve the book problem, and it would probably be a good thing to do. And, of course, it took more than a year, but that's what I did. And that book ended up not only as food politics, but because I hadn't realized how much I'd written, it ended up also as Safe Food, The Politics of Food Safety, a book that came out the following year. So that sabbatical project ended up as two books.
Almost 50 years after starting her academic career, Marion had started to see real change in the way Americans eat and think about food and nutrition. However, she started to notice that too many people in America were focusing on themselves instead of society at large, and that was partially due to the increasing influence of corporations.
At least at this stage in our history, we don't seem to be very concerned about taking care of everybody or taking care of our society as a whole, and we're very divided about whether it's the responsibility of government to do that or whether it isn't. And one result of that kind of attitude is an acceptance of the role of corporations in our life that is not necessarily the way that people in other countries view corporations. We forget that corporations are not social service agencies. And it's very easy to forget that because they are so deeply integrated into every aspect of American life. You know, when you start paying attention, you're overwhelmed by it. And this carries out to the way we regulate food safety. It's okay for people to produce technological innovations without really testing them very extensively, because let's wait and see if they cause trouble. They're probably okay. Let's see if they cause trouble, and then if they cause trouble, we'll deal with it. That's very different from the precautionary principle that's followed by a lot of other governments, where let's test first and make sure they're not harmful and then let them out. But that's the society that we live in. That's what we have to deal with. And for the food movement to operate, we can either try to change that society, or work within it and try to do the best we can within it. That's the challenge for change agents and for people who are trying to change it. Is this is what we're up against. We're up against a very individualistic, anti-social in some way, society. And the big challenge is, how do you fix that? How do you convince people that taking care of the poor is going to be good for everybody, not just the poor? And it's not going to be taking things away from them. It's ultimately going to make for a much healthier, richer, and more productive society. My dietary advice is really simple, and I follow it. And it doesn't require, I'm totally unselfconscious about it. I mean, my dietary advice is eat what you like, make sure you eat plenty of fruits and vegetables, don't eat too much junk food, enjoy what you're eating, and just don't eat too much. And that's what I do, and that doesn't require any kind of thinking. I mean, I just sort of do it automatically. I'm so astounded when people are embarrassed about eating in front of me. I don't care what they eat. you know, I do nutrition for populations, and they, one person is not going to statistically change the way the population eats. I never make comments about what people eat. I think that's their personal business. I, you know, would only comment on it if asked. And I expect people not to comment on what I eat. I'm always surprised when people say, "You eat that?" Well, yes. I like desserts. I like pizza. I like what everybody else likes. I like eating in nice restaurants. I just try not to eat too much.
Marion currently writes the Food Matters column for the San Francisco Chronicle and blogs at foodpolitics.com and for the Atlantic Food Channel. She's now currently the chair of the Council on Nutrition Policy of the National Association for Public Health Policy. And to this day, she continues to teach as a professor of nutrition, food studies, and public health at NYU.
Well, I'm teaching a course at NYU in food advocacy right now, and that course is in direct response to the question, how can I get involved? What can I do? I want to do something to improve food production or consumption. How do I do it? And that's what this course is about. I start by suggesting that people find organizations who are working on the same kind of issues that they are and start moving up through those organizations. There's no lack of things to do. We still have a food system that isn't fair, that isn't just, and that isn't healthy, and that needs to change. And if they're not going to change it, who's going to change it? Well, if I thought it was bleak, I would go home and put a blanket over my head and not teach. I don't think it's bleak at all. First of all, I can see the difference that the food movement has made. All you have to do is go into a supermarket and you can see the difference. They didn't have the kind of foods that are available now. There weren't 20 years ago the number of farmers markets that there are now, or CSAs, or young people going into farming, or restaurants that are serving local, artisanal, whatever, whatever, or people producing food products of the kind of quality that they are now, or the number of programs at universities, or the number of students who are interested, or the number of books. I mean, there are so many different objective measures of change. It kind of takes my breath away. I think it's hard for people when you're in the middle of it to see what the change was if you don't have photographs, or if you don't have some kind of memory device fixed of what it used to look like. The changes have been profound, and they're enormously exciting changes, and they're for the better. With that said, there's still plenty to do, and there's still plenty for young people to do, so this is a great thing to get involved in. You don't think you can do something about the war in Afghanistan or climate change? Get involved in the food movement. You can make somebody's life much better. People ask me, well, where should we start? I say start with schools. What's going on in schools is incredible. I mean, it isn't only the federal changes that have been made. It's on the ground, people who are cooking in schools and making healthier foods for kids. If you change the diets at schools and get kids interested in cooking and kids interested in what they're eating, those kids are going to grow up to be healthier adults. I mean, those are important changes. So I'm enormously optimistic about the possibility for making change. The challenge is to make that change reach the people who need it most. That's a big challenge. But it's not going to happen if you don't start someplace.
When she's not busy changing the world, Marion Nessel splits her time between New York City and Ithaca with her partner and can be found enjoying fresh produce from her garden and continuing to inspire students that are just like her. This program was produced by Aaron Fairbanks and Jack Inslee for HeritageRadioNetwork.org with additional research by Leah Eden. In order of appearance, the songs used in this piece are Cry For Me by the California Honey Drops, Vroom Vroom by Ball of Flame Shoot Fire, Olympia by Ball of Flame Shoot Fire, Beast in Air, Beast in Water by Snowmine, Dues Paid by Rectech, Coyote by Brothers NYC, Trial and Error by Snowmine, and once again, Cry For Me by the California Honey Drops. HeritageRadioNetwork.org is a nonprofit 501c3 organization. Learn more about us and our programming at our website, HeritageRadioNetwork.org, or connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Tumblr, iTunes, and Stitcher. Thanks for listening.
everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.